From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years, and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again, without the constant gain-loss, guilt-virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds, and the incidental carbs you find in things like dairy. Moderate protein scaled to your lean body mass, and then fat to satiety. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. I'll be asking my guests each week what their keto looks like to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we can't give you medical advice. It's always best to work with your own doctor because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. I recorded this week's episode last week at the first ever CarnivoryCon held at Boulder, Colorado. You will have heard me discuss it with its founder, Amber O'Hearn, just a few weeks ago, and it was every bit the triumph I expected it to be. She managed to pack an incredible amount into the day and fed us a wonderful lunch to boot. I'm certain it will become an annual event, judging by the interest this year. In fact, both Amber and the Low Carb Denver organisers, Rod Taylor and Jeff Gerber, had to switch up venue size to accommodate all the extra people who wanted to attend this year. I really can't recommend both events strongly enough. Well worth attending. I met some of my patrons who kindly support me in this podcast on Patreon with their monthly pledges in person at Denver, and what a pleasure that was. Thank you so much. I wouldn't be able to do this without you. If you are enjoying the podcast and would like to help me make more episodes too, please go to patreon.com/ketowoman or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman podcast website. This week's extraordinary man is Sean Baker, MD. Sean is a doctor, an athlete, a father, and a proponent of the carnivorous lifestyle. He co-hosts the Human Performance Outliers podcast with Mike T. Nelson and has a huge long list of notable achievements, which you can check out at sean-baker.com. Welcome, Sean, to the Keto Woman podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Enjoying the conference?
It's wonderful. I'm really excited to see it happening. I think it's just kind of a
kind of the
culmination of several years of all kinds of people coming together and making this happen. And Amber's done a tremendous job. Very exciting.
Absolutely. I interviewed her a couple of weeks ago and was commending her on what a great job she's done. And she, in her usual fashion, said it was just one of those things that would have happened anyway, which, well, maybe, maybe not. But like she was saying, and you just said, it's something that needed to happen. It's the time is right for it.
Yeah, I have no doubt Amber is making a big difference on this. I have a lot of respect for Amber. She's done some great stuff.
Yeah, me too. So tell me a bit about you.
About me. So I am a 52-year-old lifelong athlete. My background is in orthopedic surgery. I've kind of, for better or worse, been kind of associated with the carnivore diet as one of the sort of the, I guess, sort of figurehead of the movement, I suppose, if you want to use that term. I have been doing this for almost 2.5 years. Trying to learn as much. We're all learning at this point. There's a lot of stuff that's evolving. I've been seeing, the benefit it seems to have with people. In addition to things like ketogenic diets, which I had done for a couple of years prior to this, and you know, my evolution in diet is common to what most people do, is they get sick and then they want to get better and they use diet to get better. And that's what happened to me. I wasn't, you know, dramatically ill, but I just noted that, you know, despite being an athlete my whole life and training extremely hard and still even competing at the highest levels, my health was declining and I couldn't out-exercise or out-train what was going on, you know, until I figured out what happens with diet. And so I went through a progression of about 5 or 6 years of doing what I thought initially was the right thing, which was, you know, a lower calorie, low fat, high fiber diet, which in fact did work. I lost a lot of weight on that, but I just didn't feel particularly good and I didn't feel it was sustainable. And then I kind of transitioned into a more paleo-esque primal type of approach, did that for a while. And then as I started being influenced by people like Gary Taubes and Nina Tykols, you know, some of the other people we all know, reading some of their stuff and trying to dig into the literature and applying it in my own life, I kind of drifted more towards low-carb and ketogenic diets. And then ultimately, I just continuing on the journey, ended up on this kind of crazy carnivore path. And so that's where I am now.
And it doesn't make much sense, logically, for someone like yourself who's expending so many calories. You think, how can there possibly be an issue if the standard model that we're all told works, the old calories in, calories out works? You know, how come, you know, you were having problems?
Well, I mean, I'm not one that completely dismisses calories. I still think they're useful, and they do have an impact. That is to say, I probably couldn't eat. I mean, I could probably, if I forced myself past satiety regularly, I would gain body fat, even on a carnivorous diet. But at the same time, we have to recognize that we do have appetites. We do have satiety signals. We do have differential effects of different macronutrients and more importantly, different foods in general. I mean, there's different carbohydrates, there's different proteins, there's different fats. And so corn oil is not the same as lard, you know. And so those things all impact our body in numerous ways. And that goes outside of the calories in, calories out model. You know, and I think there's people that will tell you it doesn't matter as long as you keep the calories at a certain level and get enough protein, everything's going to be fine. And I think that tends not to hold up over the long term.
Yeah, it's just what I mean most by that, I guess, is just not a straightforward linear equation. It's much more complicated.
Not at all. Like I said, I don't think you can totally disregard calories, but I think somebody said it very nicely. I can't remember who it was. They said, it's not that calories aren't important. It's just that they're not the only thing. And I think that's a pretty fair statement.
And it really seems to depend on the context that it's in, the kind of diet that you're eating, as to the impact it has.
Yeah, I mean, everything, and you know, we heard Amber's excellent talk on that today, and I've echoed this for quite a while, and I think our expectations or knowledge regarding how macronutrients and micronutrients and calories impact us is going to depend upon a number of things, one of which is what our diet is, and our diet plays a huge role in driving nutrient requirements, probably drives calorie requirements. We certainly know that just a simple fact that protein, you know, the thermic effect of protein and the fact that it raises something called NEAT or non-exercise, you know, activity thermogenesis and, you know, the difficulty it has to converting from, you know, amino acids into actual fat. That fact alone makes it show that calories don't, it's not all about calories. And then we can argue about do carbohydrates and fat have a differential role? And I think they clearly do, although it's probably going to be some time before that's fully fleshed out.
Mm-hmm. And so what was it that led you into making that leap from keto to carnivore?
Yeah, it was, so certainly keto had helped me in a number of, you know, quote unquote health issues, mainly with regards to things like, you know, quality of sleep, blood pressure, musculoskeletal health, and those types of things. But I really, as an athlete, I was looking for a competitive athletic edge. And I started reading about the fact that a lot of athletes from days gone by would heavily utilize meat-based diets for performance. And as somebody who, you know, was always looking to, you know, try to do as good as I can, I just decided to experiment with that. And you know, and then I explored some of these the groups of people that were doing it at the time on Facebook, which a lot of people gave me criticism for, but I'm like, that's where the data was, you know? And so you look at that and it's, in my view, observing a group of people online is no different than an anthropologic study. If I were to fly out to Africa and observe those people, even though I can't speak their language and there's all those barriers there and I can only get a glimpse, I can do the same thing online and just ask 5,000 people what works for them. And I think it's a valid observation. So, you know, seeing that people were having success with that, I said, well, I'm gonna, you know, and I'd been doing it kind of off and on over about a year. I did it for a week, 3 or 4 days here, 2 weeks there. And then at one point I said, well, I'm going to do it for 30 days, just kind of do a kind of a real trial. And I didn't die. Nothing bad happened to me. In fact, I felt really, really good, even better than I had on a ketogenic diet. And so, but when the 30 days were over, I said, well, that was a fun experiment. I'm going to go back to the regular diet. And so I brought back in some of the foods, some of the plant foods that I've been eating, the salads and the, you know, fruits and some of the other, you know, other things that I enjoyed on a ketogenic diet. And I honestly just didn't feel as good. And I thought, all things being equal, I would rather feel good. And that, you know, 30 days now turned into basically 2.5 years. And, you know, I continue to not die.
And as an athlete, I'd be interested to hear your experience of how your performance changed from the original standard American, or how ever close you were to that originally, probably more healthy than that as an athlete. And then moving into the paleo, then into keto, and now carnivore. I'd be really interested to see what kind of changes you've seen with that progression.
Yeah, I think, you know, when I was eating a quote-unquote standard American diet, and I wasn't eating a lot of junk, I was still eating what most people would consider a relatively healthy diet. I mean, I did eat, you know, some desserts here and there, and I ate a little bit of junk, but I wasn't living on potato chips and Coca-Cola. I mean, I ate a lot of real healthy food all through my life, and trained hard as an athlete, you know, up until my late 30s, mid-40s, early 40s, when I started to notice just aches and pains. It was more difficult to train. My energy wasn't good. I wasn't sleeping as well. I had more, you know, I was still, I mean, I would never have been accused of being obese, but no one would say I was super lean. That would never be the case. I was, you know, right now I'm 245 pounds. Back then I was closer to 300, but I was competing in very different sports. I was competing in sports where at 6'5", 300 pounds, I was still relatively small in the sports I was competing at. And so in those cases, you know, having all that muscle mass was very beneficial to me. But as I decided that involved me not sleeping well, probably developing sleep apnea, you know, having blood pressure that was creeping up, likely having metabolic syndrome, those things to me started to get my attention that, you know, I don't want to be 300 pounds anymore. And so that's when I went into this dietary change. And again, I tried the low-fat thing for a while. I got weaker doing that, which was to be expected. You know, losing 50, 60 pounds, as a strength athlete, you're going to get weaker. I can't say I felt tremendously better, you know, as far as the way I felt overall with regards to energy or joint health. When I went paleo, I think it was more sustainable. I had better energy. But it wasn't until I went keto that I started really noticing that I don't have these aches and pains that I would normally associate with someone in their late 40s or 50s that has been an athlete your whole life. Because, you know, I played high level, you know, professional rugby. You know, you get beat up. I did
a lot of
collisions. You know, I was a Highland Games athlete throwing big telephone poles and 56 pound weights. Wow. That beats up your body. You know, I was a power lifter. I had a national record in powerlifting. All of those things take a toll on the body. And when you're, you know, and by the time you get to late 40s, early 50s, you really notice it. And when you hurt, it's hard to train. But when I went on a ketogenic diet, I felt that, hey, I don't hurt as much. And my energy is pretty good. And I can train more and I feel better. And I was leaner and I was happier. You know, I had enough fat. I wasn't starving my body of fat. But then when I went on to a carnivorous diet, I just noticed things kicked up just another gear for me. You know, it was like possibly the little higher amount of protein, because, you know, classically on a ketogenic diet, we often restrict protein because of the fear of being kicked out of ketosis. Although, quite honestly, I was never one, you know, even though I ate a ketogenic style diet, I knew I was, you know, 80% fat or something like that. I wasn't really constantly measuring my ketones because I wasn't really that concerned about it. But when I went on a carnivorous diet, I got stronger. I noticed, and this is something I measured actually. At that point, I had just set a U.S. record on the rowing machine. It's a very objective way to measure your power output. And I did that right before I turned 50. And I had a number, you know, a time for a 500 meter row. And then when I turned 50 and I had just kind of adopted this carnivorous diet, about 3 months later, I had not only broken that U.S. record, but then I broke the world record, and I broke it by about 8% which is a huge increase when you're already at a national record level. I mean, it's not going from 8% when you're a beginner to not so much a beginner is no big deal.
People break records by tiny amounts.
Typically, the records are breaking by less than 1%. Yeah. So, but to break it by, and I had broken the world record, it was, just to give a perspective, the time for 500 meter row was 1 minute, 18.3 seconds, and I brought it down to 1:14.6. I took almost 4 seconds off the world record. So, I mean, it was just a huge improvement for me. And again, it all goes back, and my recovery got better. Certainly, as an athlete, you know, we talk about adequate recovery, we talk about overtraining, and in the end of the day, results are based upon what your training's like, how intense you can train, and how frequently you can do that. So if you train intensely and then you can do that repeatedly, your ultimate performance is going to get better. But that's going to depend on your recovery capacity. And what I find on this diet is recovery is excellent. And part of that has to do with the fact that when you're training, you're breaking down muscle tissue. And the best way to build muscle tissue back up is with protein. And the best way to get protein, the most bioavailable and closely, resembling the ratios that we need are basically getting it through meat. I mean, you know, basically a cow's muscle is not qualitatively very much different than you and I. I've operated on thousands of people and we are red meat animals. And so by eating a lot of red meat, I think it helps to restore that stuff. And I'm not alone in that. And I think literally hundreds upon hundreds of people that do this now will note that their recovery for exercise is very good.
So true. Every athlete I've interviewed has said the same thing. That's been an absolute common thread that's run through. They all comment on the difference they've seen is in the recovery, you know, whether they run marathons, Ironman triathletes, CrossFit trainers, all these people, it's the recovery where they really notice.
I think there's two things. I think there's probably many things, but I mean, certainly we know that the oxidative stress level is lower than compared to being on a high carb diet. I know Volek and Finney have done studies on that. And my podcast partner, Zach Bitter, was part of one of the studies. And they said they took a bunch of ultra marathon distance guys and they checked their oxidation levels after a marathon. And the high carb guys, it was through the roof. And the low carb guys, it was relatively low. So they weren't beating themselves up as much. But I think then if you combine that with the proper nutrition to also, rebuild that torn down muscle, because we turn over about 1-2% of our muscle every day. So you got to get that building materials from somewhere. And so if you're eating it, it works pretty well.
Yeah. And what foods do you, well, obviously meat, but what do you prefer? I know you're famous for eating a lot of ribeyes, but, is that, it seems to be a lot of people, at least when they've been carnivore for a while, tend to favor beef.
Yeah.
Is that the same for you?
Yeah, it is. I mean, when I started, I was much more into variety. I mean, it was fish, it was, you know, eggs, bacon, a little bit of poultry, more dairy. And I think that helps with the transition process because you're going to, let's be honest, you're going to a fairly restrictive menu. And if that bothers you, you're not going to be able to do it. And so initially I was very much including as much as I possibly could. And it was, I enjoyed it. But as time got by, I found what I was craving more and more. And what actually gave me the most satiety tended to be some sort of red meat, typically beef, just because it's so ubiquitous. You know, lamb is also a very good source. I mean, I still do from time to time go through phases where I'll fish, it seems like it's good for a while, so I'll eat some salmon or I'll cook up some shrimp or, an eggs every once in a while. A little bit of dairy. I don't tend to do much on the dairy, but that's more or less my diet. But I mean, I would say if you were to sort of slice my diet up over a year, I would say probably 97% of it would come from red meat.
And are you a one meal a day guy, 2 meals?
Most days it's 2 meals a day, but some days I'll drop into 1 meal a day. I mean, it just kind of depends. If I can get a meal in early in the morning, then it's usually 2 meals a day. So I'll usually do like a relatively early morning breakfast and then an early dinner. So I end up with, something like 14, 16 hours of a fasting period. Although I don't intentionally set a stopwatch to say I need to, I know there's a lot of, benefit that people receive from having these eating windows. I think with a carnivorous style diet, it just happens naturally anyway. And I think when there's a point where if I'm really hungry, I think there's a reason for that. I think we have an appetite for a reason, particularly if we're only eating one thing. What else could your body be telling you other than, hey, dummy, you need some structure, you need some energy. So I think there's a reason for that. And again, it's going to be different for certain people. You know, there's people that are very metabolically in a different position. They have a lot of body fat. They have other issues that are going on where fasting may make more sense to them. But for me, as someone who is relatively healthy and a relatively, you know, normal body composition, I just eat when I'm hungry and it works pretty well. There are plenty of days that I'll go one meal a day. Sometimes I'll eat three or four meals a day. It just kind of depends on what's going on. And I don't worry about it. The nice thing about it, it's a restricting diet. It's a restrictive diet when you look at the menu, but at the same time, it's very freeing and liberating when you don't have to worry about things. You don't have to calculate. For most people, there's some people that still end up doing that, or they can't let go of that. For me, I look at it, you know, and maybe some people think this is too simplistic, but I look at any other animal out in the wild in nature, and they just eat when they're hungry. And when they're not hungry, they don't, you know, if you go, I've been to Africa and I go into the Serengeti and you look at the lions, and if they've got blood on their face, the zebras will walk right by them because they know these guys are good. They're not going to mess with them. But if they look hungry, you better watch out. And I think that's how we are probably designed too. You know, there's a period of time when, you know, you're either hungry or not. If you're not hungry, like we just said, I don't know if you had the meal. We just had a great meal here.
Yeah,
you know,
really good.
I'm good for probably, maybe till tomorrow. You know, I don't know. Maybe I'll eat dinner tonight. Maybe just socially I might eat. So, but here's the other thing. I think even if I eat beyond my appetite, you know, like say today, I'm pretty full from the beef ribs I had and the eggs and the whatever else we had there, the porchetta. I'll eat again tonight just to be social, maybe just for fun. And then tomorrow I'll be like, I'm not really hungry. I probably might eat one meal a day or something like that. I think it works out in the end, you know, with the way this diet tends to work.
And you just mentioned seeing sometimes quite a big change in your hunger levels. Have you seen a pattern with that? Like, I'm thinking sort of logically that potentially you'd have that real increased hunger after you'd been doing a lot of training, for example. That would seem a natural time that your hunger would be
absolutely
boosted.
And part of this is, you know, over time there's an intuitive process that I know I need to eat. I kind of know I need to eat X amount to fuel my day, but I do notice that when I ramp up my intensity, like when I'm getting ready to compete or I'm really pushing PRs, or getting ready to try to break a world record, my appetite goes up to respond to that. And so, whereas most days, and again, I'll put this in context, I'm a big guy, 4 pounds of meat a day is kind of typical for me. But when I'm really pushing hard and I notice that I'm hitting these real high intensities, that may go up to 5 or 6 pounds and that'll last for, a week or two, and then I'm back down to kind of my sort of maintenance mode. But certainly, I think it responds, you know, your appetite responds to the demands that are placed upon it. And I think that's how it's supposed to work.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you were saying about, the menu looks restrictive, but it is very freeing from a lot of the other factors that can influence how much you eat. Like, you know, I have a very addictive tendencies towards certain foods and, I get very snacky with things. And I certainly eat a lot of the time, not through hunger, just through boredom or emotional eating or whatever it is. The more you restrict that down, and that's one of the big things I noticed with restricting down to keto, is that a lot of those cravings and things started going away. And it must, taking it down to that extra level must almost remove those entirely.
Yeah, there's a lot of things, and there's a psychological component of eating, as we're well aware. I mean, there's some people that don't think there's such a thing as a sugar addiction. I totally disagree with that. I think that's totally there.
I mean, I have one.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, if you were to ask me what would I want to eat if I could eat something outside of a carnivore, and I can if I want to, I will if I want to. It's not that I'm strapped to some dogma or leading some church group. I would eat something sweet. I would eat some fruit or a piece of chocolate or something. That's what I would do, just because I don't really miss much in the way of vegetables. I don't really miss bread or pastas. I just don't really have that. But I think part of that is, if you become very restrictive for a while, and this is the one thing that some people benefit from going from keto to carnivore, because a lot of people on a ketogenic diet, they really, they heavily use artificial sweeteners and they make their ketos. And I did that too. When I was on a ketogenic diet, I would eat all the salads and do this and do my penance, to get my, I thought I was doing the right thing, but then I would always look for, I'm going to make this neat dessert. I'm going to use this coconut flour and almond flour and make these wonderful baked goods with the stevia and the swerve and all that stuff. And I put that in there, but that was always in the back of my mind. And so once I kind of just went all meat for a period of time, and it took probably I don't know, 2 months, 3 months. And then all of a sudden, those things didn't really even occur to me. Now, the only time at this point where those things even remotely sort of get in the back of my mind is if I'm really hungry. Like if I can't eat for whatever reason, like if I'm, you know, I missed a meal or I'm in a place where I don't have access to food. And then I'm like, I'm kind of getting hungry. I need to eat something. And so then you start looking around what's available. Generally, fortunately, it's not that hard, at least in the U.S., to find some place that'll sell you a hamburger or a steak or something like that. Or if you're at home, obviously we've got that everywhere. But yeah, I mean, I think it helps people because, you know, you have to fight both a physiological battle to get off carbs and you have to fight a psychological battle. And there's two things. And I think you can't win the psychological battle if the physiology isn't lined up. If physiology, if you're still adapted to eating a lot of glucose or using glucose as your fuel, hungry people, you know, just don't do well and you're going to cave. You're going to eat the cookies or the cupcake or order the pizza or whatever it is. You know, that's what just going to happen. So until you get the physiology in place, and that's why when I tell people on a, you know, because a lot of people get on a carnivore diet and they're like, well, I just want to lose X amount of weight. And I said, you shouldn't worry about that initially because you've got to change your relationship with food. You've got to beat these addictions. And the way to do that is to maintain your satiety at all times. And that may mean even gaining weight initially. Beat those addictions, change that metabolism, change that relationship with food. And then once you get to a point where you can walk by that chocolate cake and it doesn't bother you, then you can say, okay, now I'm gonna gently, you know, restrict things a little bit so I can hit my body composition goals. Because I think there's, you know, I see too many people, they always ask me, how much should I eat if I want to lose X amount of weight? And I always tell them, don't make that your goal initially. If you're coming to this diet, you've got to, and I think there's a guy named Chris Donahue, who is a guy who started at 530 pounds and has lost well over 200 pounds. And he said, you know, you don't lose weight to get healthy, you get healthy to lose weight. And I think that's pretty wise.
Yeah, getting it the right way around. And you're so right about sorting out the physiology, sorting out those physical cravings that can then help you with all those, you know, emotional triggers that come up. I mean, when if I'm feeling down or I've been triggered by something, I literally get images of cake or ice cream or whatever in my head. And before, it would be almost impossible to ignore those. And I'm not saying I don't still get those and I don't still get the cravings, but they're a lot easier to deal with when you're feeling physically and emotionally stronger.
Yeah, there is so much of, we've gotten so far away from the original purpose of eating. You know, eating originally was intended to nourish us, it's nutrition. And now it's entertainment, it's boredom, it's socialization, it's, you know, it's cultural overlays and all that stuff. It's, you know, pleasing other people sometimes. And it doesn't help that we have an industry that drives that message 24/7, you know, this whole thing about this snack food culture, which, you know, when I was a kid, and maybe the same thing to you, there was such thing as, you know, your mom would say, don't eat that, you're going to spoil your appetite for dinner.
Totally.
And now it's like, oh, the kid's hungry, give him a juice box, give him a granola bar.
Yeah, got to carry snacks around all the time. Yeah. And I'm no, like, it was the opposite of that.
Exactly. It's like, you know, it was like, good, you'll eat more at dinner. And then I think the French have a nice saying, I think it's hunger is the best sauce, you know, because food is going to taste better when you're hungry. And so, yeah, I mean, that is probably as much as anything is driving some of our metabolic disease processes. We've got this, and it's not to mention that the snacks are garbage anyway, but the fact that we are compelled, and it starts with kids and little, I mean, my kids in school, it always would frustrate me that you got to have a snack for two or three snacks a day. And I'm like, I didn't get that when I was a kid and I didn't die. But now we have this mentality, and we literally see kids starting at 3-4 years old, they've got to have snacks, and now it's some kind of supplement, probiotic, prebiotic, all these pills that we're giving our kids, and we're getting them sort of primed to be consumers of supplements and pills, and it's very sort of sad to see that happening.
Yeah, they were just starting to come in when I was a young kid, the whole idea of snacks, and the whole, I think the Milky Way advert was, it went against that I think every mum would say, no, don't have that. Don't ruin your dinner. And the whole thing was, it was small and light and it wouldn't ruin your dinner. But, you know, with hindsight, looking back, seeing what was this new thing and this constant push with the advertising and in the supermarkets and all the rest of it, to where it is now, where it is just assumed that you need to snack and that kids need to be fueled every couple of hours. And to a certain extent, the kind of foods we're often giving them, they do to a degree. Certainly you get those mood swings, the hyperactivity followed by the grumpiness, and then you need to put something in them to boost them up again.
Yeah, no, it's very, I think we're reaching a sort of a boiling point or a crux where so many people are sick. And we maybe things like continuous glucose monitors now where people include into that. Also, we're seeing, and it's not even hidden anymore. It's almost blatantly in the open how much backlash against things like ketogenic diets or carnivore diets or low carb diets that are out there, that it's not even like they're trying to hide it anymore. It's like you can see these industries are threatened by the fact that people are not wanting to, and I like to call it human pet food. That's something I kind of gave, you know, because that's kind of basically what it is. And so we're not wanting to eat your human pet food anymore and take all your pills. We're seeing this very aggressive pushback. And I think it's so obvious that people are looking at it and saying, of course. And hopefully with events like this and podcasts and the fact that we have social media, and it's going to hopefully sort of change things for the good. Because I think if we leave it up to these big corporations, they're not, our health is not in their interest at all.
And people are much more interested in, with everything being out there on social media and the great resources online, with experimenting a bit more on themselves and potentially, you know, going against that general advice that's being given, the statutory guidelines, you know, dietary guidelines and all those kind of things. They're more willing to start experimenting. I think the low carb carnivore, that community, we're experimenters, aren't we? You obviously are very keen on self-experimentation, and you have your N equals many. You must have had a lot of feedback.
Yeah. In fact, I'll be talking about that in this talk here in just a bit. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I think coming as from a medical background as a physician, I think physicians have kind of, not intentionally, but I think just because of the way medical practice has evolved into, you know, a business where throughput, how many patients can you see, keep turning the wheels over because of, you know, there's various reasons, there's financial reasons for that, but we don't have the time to be curious anymore. And we've got this paradigm, and some of these paradigms are built by pharmaceutical companies, and these guidelines are heavily influenced by that. And so we don't take the time to sit there and, you know, we just don't have the time to spend, you know, an hour with a patient talking to them about all these other things that may be going on. And so now that we've got physicians, because there's a bunch of physicians in this audience today that are sort of waking up to this stuff. I honestly think there's enough good people in medicine, and of course the patients are going to want it too, that this is going to evolve. And I think, you know, it doesn't take people too long to see that I'm tired of taking all these pills and I'm not getting better. Let me go look at Sally down the street who just said she got off all of her pills and she tried this diet. They can't keep that for secret forever. And so, you know, I think, like I said, I think there's, you can see it's almost like a little propaganda war that's happening out there, and it's going to continue to happen. And
it's turning, isn't it? It's like this great ship has started, but it started that turn now. And I really can see that change starting to gain the kind of momentum that you can't stop.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think I had, you know, I don't know if you know Gary Fetke from Australia. He's an orthopedic surgeon like myself that got in trouble for telling patients not to eat sugar. Ridiculous, as we all think. But we talked about, and I can't remember what the exact term he used, but it was basically talking about a school of fish and what it takes to turn a school of fish. And it's about 3%. Right. So if you get 3% of those guys turning, then you can actually make a difference. And I think we're you know, if I would say how many people in the world are on a low carb or a ketogenic diet, I say we're probably close to that, or maybe we're there. And I think we're going to see, you know, a definite continued turn in that direction. I don't think it's turning. I don't think it's going to stop.
No,
despite the best efforts.
Me neither. I feel really hopeful.
Yeah, it's fun. It's exciting.
Things are going to change a lot. Yeah. It is. It's. Yeah, it's exciting to be part of it.
It is. And I'll tell you, it's exciting to be part of this very first carnivore conference.
Oh, it really is.
I think, you know, I think looking back, you know, 15 years from now, it's going to be
great,
you know,
maybe
a place where we, you know, and that's the thing. And I'm fully supportive of any kind of diet, quite honestly. I think people have the right to do that. But I think the one unique thing about a carnivore diet is it's so much against everything else you've been taught. That the fact that everybody's not dropping dead of scurvy and dying and getting sick, but rather they're getting healthier, is so in your face, you know, that it's causing a lot of sort of thought to change. And I think that's a fun thing to see.
So where can people find out a bit more about you and the experiments you do online?
On social media, it's Sean, S-H-A-W-N, Baker, B-A-K-E-R, 1967 on Instagram. I've got 66,000 people on that. And Twitter, S. Baker, M.D., I think we've got about 35,000 on that one, 37,000, something like that. I've got a YouTube channel, just Sean Baker. I've got meatheels.com is a great website. We've just started collecting all these different stories. And one of the problems I got when I got into these Facebook groups, I could never find the things again. I'd see us. It was very difficult to manage it. So I wanted to collect all these different anecdotal stories, and we've started catalog those by arthritis, obesity, mental health issues. So anybody can go in there and say, I've got psoriasis. Well, let me look, see how many people got their psoriasis improved by this type of diet. So meatheels.com. We've got the World Carnivore Tribe on Facebook. It's the largest carnivore tribe currently. There's like almost 27,000 members on that one. We just started a year ago, so we're growing pretty rapidly. Let's see. There's sean-baker.com. I've got a little bit of writing in there and some interesting links if people might want to do that. And then, of course, got a book coming out. The Carnivore Diet should be out later this year. So that's available for pre-order now on Amazon and whatnot.
Well, your timing couldn't be better. It's the absolute buzzword and buzz thing, that new diet that people are trying. Popularity surge has been incredible over the last year.
Yeah, I think it's good. Hopefully it'll reach a wider audience. And, if it sells a lot of books, I'll be a happy guy.
I'm sure you will. And I'm sure you will.
Yeah, hopefully so. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Have you got a top tip to round us off with?
I think the probably the most common tip I tell people at the beginning is to, if you're going to transition into a carnivore diet, if you're going to go sort of just jump straight into it, and some people may need to transition, they need to slowly taper off through things like a ketogenic diet, taper out fiber, may taper out things like oxalates, or potentially that's another topic. But if you're going, once you get there, don't feel like you have to restrict. Don't cut your calories. Don't worry about micromanaging every little detail. Enjoy it. Enjoy the food. Learn how to cook. Be decadent about
Cooking's
it.
Cooking's a
know.
Big part of it.
Yeah, I mean, you learn how to make a nice steak. Enjoy these. There's lots of animal cuts out there. There are thousands of different ways you can enjoy different types of meat. And don't be shy about using eggs and even dairy in the beginning. And just get into it. And then you can start to sort of shift and change.
And it seems to be a natural progression. Like you say, you started out with a much larger variety, but you just ended up falling into predominantly beef just because that's what satiated you. That's what, your hunger signals were telling you wanted.
Right. And I sometimes like variety still. If it's there, I'll still eat it. I still enjoy it. It's just that, when I'm just cooking for myself, which I often do, it's like when I feed my dogs, they're happy. They're jumping around excited. They just get a bunch of meat. They're happy every day.
So they're carnivore too.
Yeah, they're carnivore too. They're happy dogs.
Yeah, mine are. Not completely, but mostly they found a balance. They actually do better with a bit of kibble as well for some reason.
Maybe,
but they get their meat and they love it.
They have it. Yep.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out to talk to me. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure too. Thank you.
To get the resources and links from the show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you want to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. If you fancy joining me on this exciting adventure and want to help me create new episodes, please go to my Patreon page at patreon.com/ketowoman. Or simply hit the support button on the Keto Women Podcast website. Please help other people hear about and find this podcast by reviewing the show on my Facebook page and iTunes or whichever podcast app you use. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support means the world to me. Thank you. This week's end quote is from Dennis Leary. Not eating meat is a decision. Eating meat is an instinct. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.